Well, I'm not sure of your situation, but there are many communities, for instance, out in the West, that are quite close to one another. There would have to be some adjudicatory process. I think probably the commission that would be established here in the state rather than in Washington, D.C. But for instance, you know, when the control is in D.C., and if we would have decide, you know, that we would be better protected by the Interior Department, whose responsibility it is to essentially take care of the native people, we would have probably petitioned, as was done back in the 40s, you know, by many villages, for reservations. And to this very day, you'll find very few people in the villages who support the idea of reservations. They were propagandized against them, pretty much, because the administrators, I think Greening and others, felt that this wasn't the best thing for the natives. In fact, I looked at the records in Washington, D.C. in regard to Shungnak. Shungnak is quite near some very valuable copper deposits and other minerals. And they petitioned for a reservation. They had two hearings, one in Kotzebue and one in Shungnak. And well-meaning whites and prospectors opposed the granting of a reservation to the Shungnak people because they wanted the minerals. And naturally, Kennecott Copper has a hold of the mineral land there, back there behind Kobuk. I'm not sure how large the reserve would have been, but they fought and defeated the desire of the people, you know, for this reservation, which they weren't particularly interested in for minerals, although it would have been possible for them to obtain the benefits of the minerals if they had obtained the reservation. So now we have a major outside corporation a hold of it, with the native people not benefiting from it. But more than likely, most of the villages, if they obtained any amount of land, wouldn't really have any valuable lands, except a few might be on the North Slope.
Can I ask one more question regarding the villages? When you make these claims and you want a certain amount for each village, is it for each village now functioning as a village, or will you go back and claim that amount for every historic village and have enormous
revenue?
Well, some of them have been abandoned and they've covered hunting grounds.
Yeah. Well, we couldn't possibly, I think, from a politically realistic standpoint, try to get villages that are now uninhabited. But the fact of the matter is, in many, many locations around the state, we have lands that are used certain months out of the year. For instance, I mentioned Sisolik, where many people from Kotzebue go to. It's simply a gravel spit, which is a very good hunting and fishing location. Almost all of people know it that come down there, and I'm sure there's other places like this. You know, if this were 1741, and if there were still 74 or 80,000 Eskimo, Indian, and Aleut people in the state, certainly we would, because we were more scattered in those days. We weren't located around the church or the school. We couldn't afford, from an ecological standpoint, to have large villages, because we were scattered in family groups all over the cotton picking territory of Alaska. And it wasn't too many years ago that there were many small groups of Eskimo people scattered throughout the North Slope, for instance. But now we have been consolidated because of mainly churches and schools and airports and other things. Thank you. I've taken too much time. Yeah. Well, let me say, Ms. Hitchcock, in terms of that particular point as to whether we're trying to claim land that already is held by others, we have never taken that opinion, you know, in our deliberations. When I was trying to get our region to understand the issue and what to do but to protect ourselves in terms of the disposition of lands that was just prior to the so-called freeze, The fact of the matter is, in all of those villages out there, at least in terms of the way we look at the public land law now, they were simply sitting on the public land, and anybody, you know, practically anybody could have gone to a BLM office in Fairbanks and looked down there. There was nothing on the maps, and so they would say, well, you know, I'd like this hunk of land here. They could have got half a Kotzebue, you know. And we don't know any of the dispositions that were going on. So what we were trying to do with these blanket claims, essentially, was to, in those areas where state selections were made, of course, to protest them. In the areas where there were no state selections, we were claiming them, at least the whole area of use and occupancy that we felt for that particular region. And my good friend, Edith Bullock, I wish she was here. She's unfortunately an executive committee member of the Chamber of Commerce. You know, we had great long discussions about this, and I was trying to inform her that, you know, were it any other, if it was poor whites, I'd be doing the same thing. Because I felt that these people had a right, in my reading of the law and understanding of it, that they had a right to protect themselves. And I wasn't trying to run anybody out of the country, nor were the other people. We figured if they had existing rights, they would be preserved. In fact, I'm quite sure we would be more generous with them than the state would have been in the areas that the state has made selections. They've had big court cases right down here, haven't they? Where there were some poor homesteaders who were trying to homestead some land, and they had to fight the state. And I'm sure we'd be more than generous with the people. And we're not trying to take anybody's land. We're simply trying to confirm what is ours. Thank you. Well, let me tell you, from the very beginning, once the issue started going, it was all we could do to keep up with it, you know. And we have never been funded adequately, from our standpoint, to do an adequate job of informing our own people. It takes a lot of dough to get to a couple hundred villages. To get a person there, you know, it just can't be done by the, you know, we've sent, you know, a lot of paper, but the paper doesn't mean anything if you can't read it well and understand it all. And the things that we're dealing with are quite complex. What we tried to do, for instance, in the task force, was to try to take care of all of the contingencies and try to eliminate the major conflicts, you know, in this approach of working with the state. For instance, we had villages with reservations. With executive order reservations, some large, like 1.5 million acres up north, some small, down to a couple thousand acres. We had some groups that had filings before the Indian Claims Commission. We had some who had already gotten a settlement with no land, with a poor settlement. And most of the villages could not afford, you know, to come to these meetings. And what we tried to do was, to the extent we could, to have a representative elected by each of the regions who would know that situation. I represented the Northwest. We had people from Northwest, North Slope, out in the West. And pretty much the way AFN is organized is that we left a great portion of the responsibility of working in the communities, you know, to that regional group, the Federation of Organizations. And I just returned from Grayling. They asked me to come and talk about electrification, politics, land claims, among other things. And I would say this. I think that the natives in the villages are not completely familiar with the issues. In fact, I think if this situation, frankly speaking, you know, would continue where we wouldn't get a settlement for some time, I think the provisions of what the AFN would be asking now would be substantially more in terms of land and probably money than we have in our bill. Because I feel that as time progresses, the native people in the villages are going to learn more and more about the situation. And this situation really, at least in terms of being in the shape, you know, to have to be dealt with, you know, by the Congress and by the state, has been, you know, only a very short time, really, just 3.5 years. And like I say, we've kind of just rode the crest and tried to function as best we could, as representative as we can, in dealing with the issues. And I agree. I think we could have done a better job, but we just have never had the funds, nor the kind of communications in the villages.
Well, in your own experience, if you've been out in the bush, have you run into any natives that think that they're going to be handled personally a big cash settlement?
No, I haven't had that experience so much. I don't know what it is in the urban centers where they hear, you know, the radio and read the papers and things. What I try to tell them is that the Congress doesn't support per capita payments, pretty much, and that we have provided for provisions in the legislation that would allow, you know, some amount of this to happen. For instance, at Tiamat, they have this sort of family plan, which is practically a per capita distribution. It takes care of the really basic needs of the families. A lot of it would be invested. A lot of it would be, well, come probably in dividends, like any business corporation. I hope that they are not under the impression that one of these days we're going to have a big party and dispose of all our resources to the local chamber.
I don't think there's any racial overtones.
You say there are none?
None.
You mean in the light of what has been said in the state in the last 2 weeks, you still believe that there is no racial overtones in this matter?
Absolutely. I
you
think... I don't know the particular reason why he wanted 20 years, and are you sure you're right on that? Because the thing I got here doesn't say that. Well, okay.
He also stated that he did not think that they should get anything from the outer condo ship. They left that stuff. Why did he make this?
Well, I don't know his reasons for the various things he does. Of course, the Department of Interior suggested over 20 years. I was just making a comparison. There are 8 points that the governor agrees on with the AFN that neither the Federal Field Committee or the Interior Department agree with. Why they want $500 million over 20 years, I don't know, except I do know this, that Secretary Hickel, and I hope he makes a statement one of these days, desired it. 50 million or 100 million down, the 100 million the first year and 50 million for the next 8 years. I don't think that's a hard nut to crack in the settlement of the native land claims with stayed down on the farm once he got educated. And I think we're going to see the same thing in the village areas. I think the older people, sure, they're going to stay there probably the rest of their lives. But I think the younger people are not. I know Senator Gravel is working for the city-borough concept, and it's something really, I don't find in any of the bills, and yet I feel confident it's probably going to come out of one bill, and I think it's something hasn't been mentioned. I think it's very important. I think the important thing is that that we integrate the entire state of Alaska into one system of values substantially, and it's going to happen. This gives us an opportunity to speed it up, and I think when we talk in terms of 30 miles that somebody needs out of one village, 10, 15 years from now, nobody's going to use 30 miles from any one village. There are going to be darn few people hunting to any extent at all in 20 years. Well, I don't think I'm not going to try to force them, but I'm predicting is that when the AFN, when these various groups get their money, that's the direction they're going to go. And not my word. This is I say this is one of the points that Brookings Institute I think has brought out beautifully in every session. They brought people and they've just expressed trends throughout the world, not even the rest of the United States. And I think if you remember back to your early days, if you happen to live in a farm area. I did. It has happened. As we get better educated, we want more diversity of job opportunities. We want some of the nicer things in the cultural way of living, and we're going to gravitate towards that. And I think that the with or without a native land claim settlement, with the additional money the state has, we're going to create that atmosphere because we're going to raise the health standards, and we're going to raise the educational standards throughout the state. No, I'm saying we're going to do that whether they get it or not. The state's got the money. Well, we've never had the state's never had the money to do a lot of things. The BIA has been doing it, and they haven't been doing a very good job. The state hasn't been in a situation to try to build high schools and hospitals and things of this sort all over the state. We're in a situation today where we can, build roads, where we can connect people so they can easily go back and forth.
What justice would it be in turning this money over to white, nominating organized boroughs and cities for administration?
Well, I don't mean white. I mean, I assume if it's a native village, it's going to be a native city. You've got, what's it got? It's got 5% to the state, and then
the regions have 75% of the total back down to the village.
I think that's substantially correct, but you're talking about village councils, or the language is not the language of the constitution of the state, and we are all citizens of the state. I think it ought to be language of the constitution of this state, which deals in state government, city, or borough, or you do have certain classes of villages.
Is there a moderator or a con?
Well, politically, I'm not sure what you mean by politically. I think that, let me put this way, I think some of the people that are opposed to the 2% overriding royalty, we don't feel it's necessarily just or equitable, but we feel there are several substantial dangers. One, of course, is that one part of the citizenry of this state will receive a certain amount and then their full pro rata share of the balance. We feel that it will build up a fund, and the way this native land claims bill is set up, where the there's definite limitations on the alienation of land and money, and we feel that a tremendous amount of money will develop into one of the state fund or the regional funds, but primarily because the native villages aren't aware of what all is going on. We look at it as maybe a half a dozen or a dozen attorneys and maybe a dozen native leaders will have untold political force because of the fact that the settlement is tied up in a knot. Now, Willie and others may poo-poo large amounts of money, but you take a 2% overriding royalty. I could easily foresee within 10 years there'd be $2 billion tied up. Now, I really don't object if the money gets to the people. But I don't think this thing is set up to get it to the people for many years. Politically, we feel that if the money does end up in one big pile, or 12 piles having the same attorneys for all 12 piles, that there'll be a political force far beyond the scope of Alaska. We feel there'll be a political force in the entire United States. And that 12 or 20 people will control have the tremendous influence that $1 billion or $2 billion has. The $900 million, of course, is owned by the state of Alaska, and the people who make that law are elected by the people every 2 years or every 4 years. So I think it's subject to a lot more scrutiny. Mm-hmm. Well, you can argue that. I think Willie indicated a while ago that some of the people in the village don't know all the terms, and I think they don't. And I think that the people who vote in statewide elections, I don't know, I think that they're going to, in their 2 or 4 year elections, the people will keep control of it. It isn't going to be some private group having the influence of that dough. But of course, I think the biggest reason is, as far as I'm concerned, I don't feel it's a justified part of any settlement, any royalty in perpetuity. I think $500 million and the native land ought to be enough to allow a group that hasn't come into the mainstream, and poverty is part of it, that it ought to get rid of that poverty problem. It ought to bring them up to the same level as everybody else, and they can all be in the mainstream.
Well, in short, our position has been pretty much not to cut ourselves down before we get to where the cutting is done. You know, And naturally, we realize that what we've opted for essentially is a political process, a political settlement. And from my reading of the matter, before it really became an issue, I felt that what we ought to do is stress the land figure, because the pressure has always been for a financial settlement, because it's easier to gyp the Indian out of money, you know. Well, the way we had it set up was, in our initial observation, was we felt that a great portion of the settlement should go to the village, you know, to the village level. And we provided essentially a structure that we already pretty much had, you know, through the federation. We had villages, we had regional organizations, and then we had a statewide federation. And it's taken some time to develop the ideas and concepts in the legislation now, but we've never really been sure what was politically possible, you see. And we were quite in the dark as to how to approach it, you know, whether we should try to do it as, you know, as a group of Eskimo, as a group of Indians, as a group of Aleuts. But what we did essentially was opt for a regional setup, you know, more or less in place of a kind of a tribal structure, which you have throughout the country. We had regions that were pretty well tied together through marriage between the villages, or through a central communication system, pretty much, and a pretty, you know, pretty well defined, in most regions anyway, geographic region with people who are pretty much alike. And so we provided for the bulk of the funds to go directly to the village, and they would be in control of their lands and funds, and we provided another smaller portion for the regional organization, you know, which we figured would be pretty much of an investing group, you know, that would be involved in devising businesses of one sort or another, and then with the statewide group. Part of our thinking revolved around our desire to have as much control within Alaska of these resources, rather than having the secretary, you know, which is the traditional method, you know, whether it was Secretary Hickel or anybody else. Now, Tom is fearful about this awesome political power that he talks about, and you know, he makes no bones about the fact that, you know, we have some people in the state who are very powerful politically because they have a lot of money, and he doesn't argue that they're a harm to the state, you know. You know, is Bob Atwood harmful to the state because he has lots of dough and a powerful voice, you know, in the state? We feel that, you know, it's the American political process that we're working in, you know. We've opted to go through that route, and we've done pretty damned well, you know, for a pretty small group. And we're going to continue working within that political system, you know. At one point in time, someone described me as an anarchist, you know, because I wasn't agreeing with everything that everybody was doing. But actually, I'm an anarchist within the system. I agree. I believe in trying to work with the system, and that's what I do. I think that it's unreasonable to think that the Native people are going to turn themselves over to, you know, some big lawyers. The fact of the matter is, from the very beginning, even before the Federation was formed, we knew the threat that we faced of, you know, fighting off those who would like to use us for one purpose or another, you know, either for political power, for elective purposes, or possibly financial power, once we ever obtained a settlement, which at that time was very distant. And I think if you observe the news closely, and read the press, that at some specific times during the existence of AFN, you've seen some pretty difficult political internal struggles and struggles with our attorneys. And to me, this is simply a continuation of something that has been around since prior to the formation of the Federation. Those of us who've been actively involved feel that the Native people ought to be in control of their own resources. But you all know, and I think Tom realizes that, you know, the power and money is something that most people seek after. In the mainstream, I should say. I don't think you find this to the extent in the villages. And he talks about integrating the whole state. This is a fine idea and it's occurring, but if I don't take too long, I'd like to mention a trip I just took to France. It wasn't all muckduck, like it was reported in the press. I had a few other statements to make, but I met many Greenlanders there, and there are some 30,000 or more Greenlanders in Greenland. And the Danish government has had pretty much a policy of trying to keep the ravages of civilization from tearing them up too badly, and that you couldn't get to Greenland without permission of the Danish government. And what they've done is at least recognize the fact that these people were different, that they had a separate language and culture. It wasn't their plan especially to integrate, assimilate, you know, and annihilate this culture as fast as possible. They have utilized their language, the Eskimo language, which is pretty close to the Northern Eskimo dialect, and they teach through 12 grades of school in Eskimo. And the biggest issue not is not land over there in Greenland and with the Danish people, it's a question of language, because the Eskimos in Greenland, they call themselves Greenlanders, you know, want to preserve their language, and the Danish government feels that in order to be equal to the Danes, you've got to learn Danish from the cradle, you know, and are trying to impose Danish on the people. And as I've said to others before, right now most Europeans think Danish is a useless language because it doesn't fit the modern world. So I don't think the Danish people have a lot of argument. And they put me on the spot, those Greenlanders, you know. And most of them spoke Eskimo fluently, wrote it, they write it, use it in their magazines and stuff. And they spoke Danish and some, you know, French and English. And they put me on the spot because, you know, you come from Alaska, and there they force you to learn English. You know, it's the policy of the state and the federal government to not to teach in your native tongue. And I said, well, they said, how is it there? You know, are the native people becoming equal to the whites? You know, which is what the Danes are telling the Eskimos. You know, they'll be equal to the Danes. And, you know, what would your answer have been if you were there, you know, if you were an Eskimo? You know, who could understand the language but not speak it as well? You know, I didn't know what to answer, but what I told them was simply the fact that I felt that our system was a very brutal system. I said, yes, we can make it. You know, I can make as much as maybe not Tom Fink, but, you know, some of the others here, some of the teachers. And, you know, from that standpoint, I can be accepted in society. You know, but America has to live with its own experience. You know, what it's done in terms of race relations. But I told him, sure, we could make it. You know, but in the process, you practically have to de-Eskimo yourself, you know, which is ethnocide. And I said, it's a very tough system. Very small group of people can make it if they don't, you know, accept the change. And what they're concerned about is they want to preserve their group. And this is an inherent kind of thing that people want to preserve themselves. And essentially that motivates us to some extent. Because by holding land, we feel that we can protect ourselves to some degree and maintain our group. And I see nothing wrong with that. You know, some people feel that, you know, we ought to integrate and assimilate as fast as we can, because that way you'll, you know, maybe not have any problems. But to me, you know, the native people up here should be a, you know, a group of people that the state would foster their diversity, you know, and their language and their culture and their art and their dance. But no, the policy has been throughout the years, starting with the very missionaries who bore the gospel, you know, don't speak Eskimo, don't speak Indian, you know, take them away from their homes, and, you know, and things will be better. But that's not been the case.
white policy to the left for United States property, who believes the minority child of being a very self-identity, have you ever gotten any intelligent discussion?
No, you can't find much intelligent discussion among any many Alaskan politicians. So. I mean, well, we have exceptions like Tom Fink, but they're very rare. Thank you. I think I've said too much.
I'd like to, on the subject of land, to be very harmful and more poor.
Well, I'm not sure about that. The problem is that, you know, this whole concept of private ownership, you know, is something that's new to most of the native people in the States, you know, of having a title, you know, to a piece of property. And this is, you know, something we're going to have to live with, and we recognize, you know, it's not been like it has been before, where we were free to use, you know, all of the land that we had been using for a long time. And many people in the villages don't realize, you know, the land ownership methods of the country. You know, you could fly all the way across the country and see it's sectioned off, and this is what I try to tell the people in the villages. You know, I show them a picture from the air and they see all these. And this matter of, you know, ownership means that you can control it and people can't use it, you see, and this has not been our system. And I can see where the people would feel disturbed about that. And as a matter of fact, you know, when Alaska is fully developed, that will be the situation, pretty much, of land disposed of. That is, unless some of our friends, the conservationists, manage to take out most of the public lands, which the country feels that, at least in our during our stay in Washington, you know, most of the country feels that they own Alaska. In fact, that is true today. You know, 97% of Alaska is essentially federal land, right, to this point. Although we have a dispute between we and the federal government as to the ownership, still under their control. And they have a right to be disturbed about it. But unfortunately, you see, the native people have essentially, you know, not been against whites as such. You know, we've generally cooperated and helped. You know, the poor guys were starving to death during the gold rush days. We had to help them live, as we knew how to live there until all the game was shot off by the miners who came 40,000 strong. And then we had to bring reindeer and other things. But I am concerned about polarization. I wish you were talking about some geological malfunction where everybody was moving towards the south and north poles, but we can do without that polarization. And unfortunately, I think these slanted articles by W.C. Arnold, you know, diverge on this kind of propaganda, you know, where you have innuendo and Eastern lawyers and, you know, this kind of thing. I think it's very, very poor writing. Thank you. I'm talking too much.
You're asking, in essence, I think, and you may
changes. If natives have a right to ask for 2% royalty to be used in certain ways, might other groups be allowed to get the 2% royalty to be used for purposes that they see fit? Is this what they're saying?
Yes, this really is what I'm saying. If you were allowed 2% royalty, could the rest of us who live in the state ask for the same kind of coverage so that we could have services similar, maybe 50% set up at the same amount of money?
From whom would you be asking the 2%?
The same government that you're asking.
Well, I certainly would have no objection to that. I think it would be a very wonderful kind of thing. I think you're making the presumption that the native people would use the 2% royalty for very specific kinds of public beneficial purposes, and you mentioned hospitals and schools as two examples. I think we just have to go back again to Mr. Fink's comments that there is suddenly raised for the state of Alaska the specter that whatever sums of money or land become available to the native people will be in the control of a very small group of people, probably somewhat equally split between attorneys and a handful of native leaders. Well, I think this is far from the case, and it's, you know, I don't think worth arguing. But, you know, over the years, the native people have stressed constantly to both the state and federal governments that the kinds of things that they were really interested in doing for their people was creating a kind of quality life that would give them the opportunity to do the kinds of things that they felt they had to do, whether it was staying in a village or going to MIT and becoming a nuclear physicist. You know, they're seeking opportunity, and the kinds of things that in this country give people opportunity is basically an educational function. Be able to work within the system, you've got to be able to know what handles to pull throughout life within that system, and this is basically a function of the educational process. And of course, one of the things that Native people suffer the worst in this country is with regards to health, where some of the most severe health problems in the entire nation are suffered by the Alaska Native people. And I think that at least partly in the back of your mind, and I hope that you will bear with my presumption of some of the attitudes that I think you have, is that if we're allowed special kinds of things, special kinds of considerations, why should the rest of Alaska's people be allowed those same kinds of things? I think that this is definitely right, and I think that this is something that at least the state of Alaska has the opportunity to take a hard look at this point in its history. The state of Alaska, over and above the $900 million, is going to receive I think that in the short-term future, the state of Alaska, $900 million is going to be small step to the kind of revenues that the state is ultimately going to achieve, and the kinds of things that the native people are getting from the federal government, and as a matter of compensatory justice, mind you, for the kinds of inequities that the federal government has recognized it has perpetrated upon the native people in the areas of especially health care and special education and so forth. I think that these kinds of things should be available to all the people of Alaska. I certainly do think that, for example, the state of Alaska should assume the kinds of obligations for all of its people, every citizen of the state of Alaska, that the federal government has assumed for the Alaska Natives. For example, I don't see any reason at all that with the kinds of resources that the state's going to have available to it in the very near future, that a homesteader living out in some area of rural Alaska shouldn't have the same kinds of opportunities to attain health care as a native living maybe further out down the track line, and that the native person really does have available to him the opportunity to contact the public health service, and if
his health condition warrants it, be transported to Anchorage or some other health center and be given care that that is at the expense of the federal government. I think that these are the kinds of things that the state of Alaska and all the people of Alaska have to take a hard look at. I certainly do think that all people are, you know, within our society, when society achieves the capability, have a basic right to these kinds of things. I think that America owes to every citizen a basic standard of living, and this is all part of it. Fear on the part of Native people, and it may not, and this is speaking very personally, and it may not be shared by many other Natives or other non-Natives, but it goes back to the kinds of things that Willie was saying about the kind of brutal society in which we live, as far as the constraints upon class individuality. And recently I had the opportunity to present a paper to the Brookings Institute, and I like, you know, to the Conference on the Future of Alaska, and I like to paraphrase at least one section of my paper which responded partly to this subject. And that is, throughout the history of the nation, whenever the subject of the phasing out of the BIA or the public health service, and especially the BIA, has come up, it's engendered a very visceral reaction on the part of Natives and the American Indians in total opposition. And within Alaska, we've suffered the same kind of thing. Our termination has been talked about. It's almost a gut reaction of Native people say no. It's my feeling that Native people recognize very well that that there's one basic concept within the structure and the policy of the federal agencies that are specifically responsible for American Indian affairs, and that is these agencies recognize special kinds of problems. They recognize that American Indians have special educational problems. They recognize that American Indians have special health problems. They recognize, in large instance, that American Indians have different cultural problems, that they have different kinds of foci in just about everything that they do. And it's given them something to grasp in the conduct of their lives. And what I said is that, as far as Alaskans are concerned, and this is still a personal opinion, that when you talk on a one-to-one basis with many Native people, they say, yes, we are opposed to the termination of the BIA, but they really haven't responded to the kinds of problems that we've got, the kind of educational system that they give to us, also we're able to at least talk with these people, still isn't the kind that we want, and in certain instances, Native people even say, yes, we think the BIA should be phased out. Still, I think that Native people are willing to accept the BIA and the Public Health Service over the state as the lesser of two evils. And I think that that's because until government, and in this instance, state government, can adopt a basic governmental philosophy, a basic governmental policy that recognizes that there are differences among human groups, and that these differences have to be responded to in very different kinds of ways, that you'll constantly get this kind of reaction. And it really doesn't have anything to do with we want to keep it because we won't have to pay doctor bills, or we want to keep it because, you know, we get a free airplane ride to Chilocco every fall. As a matter of fact, you know, because it comes, it's caused some problems to a lot of parents and children. But I think that when you come right down to it, that this is the basic reason that you get this kind of reaction. And yes, AFN still very much is opposed, from what I can gather, to the phasing out of the BIA and the PHS, whether or not there is a land claim settlement. Although you're probably aware also that several other bills and several other proposals now before the Senate would have the BIA phased out. Well, the latest proposal by the two Alaskan senators would phase the BIA out over a period of 5 years, and would, and this is being proposed at this very time, would phase the PHS out immediately upon the passing of the Act, and would extend to all Alaskans the services of the public health service, not on the basis of race, but on the basis of need, which would mean that whatever criteria was set out, that people who met this criteria could avail themselves of the services of the PHS, and whether they be non-native or non-native, and even natives who could not meet the criteria, which would probably be income criteria, would not be able to avail themselves of public health service facilities. But, you know, AFN is, at this point, not changed its attitude or policy concerning these agents.
I have a question. For Dr.
LaFleur,
for the tax relief bill, did you
What
was
the question again?
From what federal source is the tax revenue
based on? Well, it's just the general tax revenue of the federal government. That's the Interior Department. The administration position just be general tax revenue.
Our time is running short, and I was wondering if someone has another question, we'll be able to take questions for about maybe 10 more minutes. And then if the men wish to have a short summing up statement, they can do so. Then afterwards, if they're willing, maybe those who still have questions could move down toward the front and ask them at that time. We show the film at 7 o'clock when we advertise the film. It would be shown at 7 o'clock, and we showed it at 7 o'clock. So if there's Mr. Miller, Reverend Miller.
Statement that the natives would
not be disturbed at all in the land that they lived on or used. In the Statehood Act itself, if you will check, you'll find the one use of the word compact is that word is when the people of Alaska agreed not to take over land held or used. I'm not sure exact term by the federal government part of it. In the native village where I live, the natives were told that if you vote for statehood, you won't be voting, you won't be losing any of your rights and privileges that you are enjoying now. This was the general tenor of the whole discussion. Some of those who fought statehood bill are the same ones who are now fighting the native land claim settlement, as you well know. Now, in the light of this, of these things, do you feel that the state of Alaska is doing the moral thing, the right thing, taking the present position that the state administration has?
I think the state is, and not that the state is fighting the native groups, but I've heard it said, and I really haven't researched it, but I've never heard anybody say otherwise, that no state has ever participated in the settlement of Aboriginal claims. Now, that's the only hang-up that I see in the state getting involved in it. No state has ever done before. The federal government has always taken care of it. Whatever rights the natives have, or whoever has taken something away from, has been the federal government. The federal government, by the statehood bill, in essence gave us a warranty deed to 103 million acres of land. Now they seem to say, well, you can have that 103 million acres if you're willing to pay 2% overriding royalty on it in perpetuity for a certain period of time. So maybe the federal government hasn't been fair with us either. If they gave us 103 million acres, if I give you a warranty deed and I give Dr. Tower a warranty deed, I'm gonna be sued. I'm gonna have to pay, and that seems to be what they're doing. They gave us 103 million acres. Now they say maybe you ought to pay an overriding royalty on it. I don't think there'd be any question about the overriding royalty. Congress has never talked about the state paying before. They're talking about it because we got $900 million and because we are more wealthy than any other state in this nation. You asked?
I'm not concerned about the overriding royalty. I'm concerned about the fact that the state wants their 103 million acres of land, no matter what the native people want, no matter what they pick to have.
The state doesn't want that in preference to the native villages. Even the governor that has been attacked this evening has made it clear that any land the state has already selected, which would come within the immediate environs of native villages, the state will convey to the native villages. I don't know what the fight at Nanana is. Well, it could be the question the state agrees that the native village areas, maybe one township or two townships. Now, if it's beyond that, I don't know. And if it's within that, I don't understand either, because I don't think there's any question but the legislature and the governor would appropriate lands in the immediate vicinity of the native village that the state now has that they give it to the natives. I've suggested that the state of Alaska go ahead and select the 7 million acres in the native villages and give them to the natives. And out of our 103 million acres, that wouldn't bother me a bit. Out of 103 million acres, we can easily afford 7 million acres. 7 million. Well, the difference is this term native use would be the thing. If it goes to courts, that's the thing that will be interpreted. And I don't think walking over the land one time or once a year constitutes use in the legal sense. nor in a properly just sense. Maybe Mr. Hensley can tell us if he feels that they've been discriminated by statehood. I don't think they have. I think that they've been enriched by statehood the same as everybody, as the rest of the citizens of the state have been enriched by statehood. And we didn't have the native land claim problem solved then. I wish we would have solved it. It'd been an awful lot easier for everybody.
We're going to start a new round of debates. Where are you going, Bob? You know, if it were necessary to have voted to have eliminated the North Slope and Northwest from the boundaries of the state, Alaska would have written off the North Slope and Northwest in 1958 and said, "The heck with them, you know, we want statehood." But now, naturally, that there's a little wealth up there, they want it in the state. I can understand that position. naturally, statehood was sold to the natives on the basis that it was going to be good for us. And I haven't really thought about it that much. Sure, we've elected representatives in the past from the bush, but they were naturally interested in, not particularly interested in the kind of things that we've been pushing for now. And generally, they were specific interest legislators. And it's fortunate that we are, at least were able to get elected. Some of us, we had to run like everybody else to get elected. But I can't make a categorical statement, except in relation to the lands issue. We are in jeopardy in terms of the land because of statehood, because the Congress didn't face up to the issue at that point and swept it under the rug, essentially, because of the great support throughout the country and in Alaska for statehood. And in many ways, yes, we benefit, because to some extent we were able to control a good portion of the law, of the fish and the game, to get away from the controls of the W.C. Arnolds who and the Seattle fishermen and West Coast fishermen, and we're able to go out on our own, you know, which has been good to some extent. But the fact of the matter is that under any kind of a system, whether it was under the state or as a territory, the native people would have had problems, because we are in a, in a changing world, and our way of life is changing, and the pressures of this so-called civilization are on us, you know, the fish and the game, and we're not going to be, in fact, probably the fish and game, the rights of we've had to hunt and fish and live off the land are going to be jeopardized and are being jeopardized daily by industry and by state law. We have no representation on the Fish and Game Board, for instance. Those of us who use the land as subsistence, in a subsistence way. And as a matter of fact, the way you can simply look at this problem is, it used to be that the Indian tribes, you know, had to go to Washington, you know, to meet with the president, and they did, many of them, or his representatives. You know, and when they created the Bureau of Indian Affairs, it was in the War Department, and they had some of the most well-known men, including Benjamin Franklin, who were some of the earliest commissioners. I think they divided the United States into about four different sections, and had well-respected for the, in those days, in the colonies, men, you know, to deal with the Indians. They dealt on a one-to-one basis. Well, what we're doing now, essentially, is we're trying to negotiate a settlement with all of the Congress, who reserved to itself the right to deal with these problems. And in my opinion, the Congress had plenary power over what happened in statehood, you know, what revenues the state got, what areas of land it would eventually have, or how much. And I think right now they still have this power to determine what the provisions of a settlement are going to be, you know, with the native people. And this is what we're involved with is a historical thing. It's a continuum. It's something that's happened with others before, and it's continuing, and we are the last group left, you know, they have to deal with on this basis. And it's not a question of race, it's a matter of government policy. It's kind of like an inheritance, you know. Who do you deal with, you know? Who are the recipients? This is a thing that's not new at all. It's something that's been with us. It's just that it's now being dealt with, and we feel the sooner we can take care of this issue, the better off we're all going to be and continue developing the people of our state.
If none of you have anything further to add, speaking to the speakers, I think we'll tie it up for tonight. Okay, I'd like to thank men for coming and